This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
And coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's primary election is tomorrow, but voter turnout is being undercut by beautiful weather. A secret torture camp has opened in Canada, triggering protests. And two Ugandans working as security contractors in Iraq slipped into a coma after being assaulted and sodomized on the grounds of a U.S. airbase.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,444 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 39,296 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead.
Oregon's primary election is tomorrow, but voters appear to have their attention elsewhere, perhaps on this week's warm weather. Barely one quarter of the nearly 140,000 registered voters in Marion County had returned mail ballots by Friday. Barely one-fifth of Oregon's 2 million voters had returned ballots, although the state compilation of the country of the county returns lags by a day. Polk County returns were somewhere in between. Although returns are higher in the 2 days before an election, those rates suggest that overall voter participation could be closer to the 1998 record low of 34.9% rather than the 2002 mark of 46.6%. It's too late to mail ballots in time for them to reach elections officials by the deadline of 8 p.m. Tuesday. Postmarks do not count. Voters are advised to drop off their ballots at approved sites in Marion and Polk counties. Oregon has a closed primary. Only registered Democrats and Republicans can cast ballots for their party nominees. All voters, regardless of affiliation, can decide nonpartisan offices and ballot measures.
Voters in Morrow County, Oregon, will decide a tax measure tomorrow that could lead to a construction of a motor speedway in eastern Oregon with races by 2008. The proposed 8% tax would be charged against tickets and goods and services within a special raceway district. The proceeds would be used to pay for roads and utilities for the $300 million track, which has been in the works for several years. The site is 5 miles west of Boardman, along Interstate 84. Sponsors envision seating more than 80,000 people in a facility that could accommodate a variety of racing events, from drag races to stock cars and go-karts, and would include an RV park and campground. The Port of Morrow set aside about 1,000 acres in hopes of boosting the local economy.
A new report is outlining Oregon's problems with university funding. Public university spending has fallen faster in Oregon than in any other state over the last 15 years, according to information presented to the State Board of Higher Education. As for actual dollars allocated per student, only four states spend less than Oregon. This year, Oregon universities have already absorbed $18 million in cuts. And it shows. Oregon State, for example, has increased class sizes and dropped course choices. Western Oregon University faculty members nearly went on strike earlier this year, and faculty at Eastern Oregon University have lodged a vote of non-confidence against their president.
The Crossing East Heritage Festival is next Saturday, May 20th. And live with us in Studio 2, we have KBOO programmer Dimay Roberts to talk about the event and the ideas behind it. Dimay, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you.
We should start by talking about your work with Crossing East. Can you share with listeners, what is Crossing East and why did you start it?
Well, Crossing East is the first ever Asian American history series that's comprehensive to ever air on radio or television. And so it's an eight-part series that is running on radio stations all over the country, and KBOO will probably run it later this summer. I felt that as an Amerasian, I kept waiting for somebody who was more Asian to do it, and nobody did. So it's a long time in coming. It's something that should have been done maybe in the 90s and hasn't been.
The issue of immigration and multiculturalism is squarely in the public eye right now. You've interviewed many people from around the world as part of your media work. Why are U.S. citizens so challenged about these issues? Why is it good for the mainstream of Americans to spend time understanding other cultures?
Well, that's a pretty long question there, so I'll take it apart there. What I think is important about, especially now what's happening with the immigration, shall we say, debate or crisis, is that unfair and discriminatory laws are not new as far as immigration for Asian Americans, beginning with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Asians have the dubious distinction of being the only ethnicity targeted for exclusion from the U.S., and that didn't change until 1965, actually, with the Immigration Act reform, where whole families could finally be allowed to immigrate here. So America has a love-hate relationship with immigrants. We love the labor, but hey, don't stick around, especially immigrants of color. Don't stick around and become citizens. So I think what's important to note is, especially now what's happening, is that Asian American communities have come out for the illegal immigrants and the issues surrounding that, because the laws need to be changed and there has to be, intense reform. And we're not going to do that unless people are out in the streets, because it's a crisis. It's a total crisis. So what we're doing with Crossing East is to give that comprehensive history so perhaps people can learn, because, as I said, Asians have that distinction of being excluded and facing discriminatory immigration laws of all the ethnicities who have immigrated here.
So what's happening this Saturday at the Crossing East Heritage Festival?
Well, what's happening is that APA Month, Asian Pacific American Heritage Month in May, has been around for 30 years, but most states don't even know what it is, let alone celebrate it. Portland is very progressive, as we all know, and it's been celebrating APA Heritage Month for many, many years. And it has actually one of the most events, the busiest APA Month's events are in Portland. So what's missing, though, from the APA Month is the heritage part, because it's not taught in schools. It's not, in the media, except with the Crossing East series, and the history is just not being focused on. So what we're doing with the Crossing East Heritage Festivals, we're connecting that history directly with performers and exploring cultural traditions, but also looking at the experience and the history of Asian Americans, particularly in the Northwest, in that history, and giving more of a connection. So we're doing that on May 20th at 7:30 at Park Rose High School. It's a celebration, of music, dance, and heritage, and we have some of the best performers around the Northwest who will be there, Min Tron and company, who's an acclaimed dancer. His company is going to be there to perform his refugee boat story, and dancer Chizao Hata is performing an internment, a personal story about internment, Japanese American internment. We also have a Cambodian group coming from Tacoma to perform basically music that we wouldn't hear otherwise. There are very few Cambodian performers, so they're coming all the way from Tacoma to perform for us that night. So it's a lot of people you may not be able to see otherwise, and interspersed with that, little snippets of Crossing East and what the show is about, but also about the history that we don't have otherwise. We wouldn't hear about it otherwise.
Great. Well, we very much look forward to that program coming out. As a final question, what can listeners do to find out more about this heritage beyond this Saturday's event?
Well, you can log on to crossingeast.org, because there we have perhaps the most comprehensive resources and listings of Asian American history in the country, if not internationally. So I would go to crossingeast.org, and you'll find information about the festival and a timeline of the history, and some of the best scholars around the country are on that site.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was KBOO producer Dime Roberts of the Tuesday morning radio zine show Stage and Studio. The Crossing East Heritage Festival is this Saturday, May 20th, 7:30 p.m. at Park Rose High School, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street in Portland. And for more information, go to www.crossingeast.org.
Oregon farmers cultivated more than 17,000 acres of strawberries at the industry's peak in the mid-1950s. Labor costs, too few pickers, and competition from California have made Oregon strawberry farmers a rare breed. Only about 2,000 acres of strawberries will be harvested in Oregon this summer, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The strawberry industry, once an icon of Willamette Valley agriculture, barely registers when compared with the state's largest crops, such as grass seed and nursery stock. Oregon grass seed growers, for example, planted about 500,000 acres last year. Oregonians might look down on California strawberries as poor substitutes for flavorful local berries, but this Golden State has the edge in lower prices and production. California farmers expect to harvest over 35,000 acres of berries this year. Oregon still has a significant amount of strawberry acreage compared with other states, ranking as the nation's third largest strawberry producer in 2005, although it accounted for 1% of the national production.
It's a case of cops gone wild. Two Corvallis police officers violated regulations when they posed for photographs with lingerie-clad women while investigating a noise complaint at a college party. In a recently released report, Corvallis police officials said officers Jason Harvey and Ryan Thayer violated several of the department's policies. The photographs appeared on MySpace.com, the online social networking site. Thayer resigned in March following accusations that he had sex with an Oregon State University student while he was supposed to be on patrol. The report says Harvey and Thayer did not break any laws and their activities at the party did not interfere with their duties. It's recommended that Harvey be reminded of the department's expectations for professional conduct. A department spokesman says officials expect to take no additional action.
Next Sunday, May 21st at 7 a.m., PGE plans to blow up the main cooling tower of the mothballed Trojan nuclear plant. The blast is expected to last 8 seconds, but the Trojan story has lasted for years, and it's not over yet. Lampooned by Matt Groening in The Simpsons, Trojan was found to be defective before construction even finished back in 1975. Once it opened, PGE was criticized by local media for charging local electricity ratepayers for the cost of its multi-million dollar visitor center. Today, 13 years after its closure, a case is still pending before the Oregon Supreme Court to prevent PGE from recouping from taxpayers its $500 million costs in mothballing the plant. All this week, the KBOO News presents a retrospective on the ill-fated plant. Tonight, KBOO's Lisa Loving interviews attorney Greg Cafuri, who helped lead the three ballot measures to shut it down.
There were about nine plants, Westinghouse plants, that had the same defect that Trojan did, and that is the steam generators began to leak before their life expectancy had been reached. So the other eight plants that had that problem, they just took out the steam generators and paid $250 million and put in new ones. With Trojan, they had to face the likelihood that the plant was going to be closed anyway by citizen action. So when it came time to decide whether to spend the money and try to keep the plant going or to just give up, they gave up. But everybody else that had the same problem that didn't have a citizens' movement against them went ahead and fixed them and ran them.
Here, now, just for the record, Bechtel also was contracted to build Trojan, right?
Bechtel built the plant, the physical plant. Westinghouse built the internal components, including the steam generators, which crapped out early.
Now, this stuff is important because, in the end, it turned out there were so many defects in construction. Do you have a minute to talk about?
Sure.
I mean, there were many.
Oh, yes.
In fact, even at some point when they tried to fix some, they made them worse.
The plant was built with about half the earthquake capacity that it was designed to have. And this was discovered and concealed for some period of time. And then in 1977, they owned up to it, and the plant was closed for 9 months while structural repairs were made. There was a lawsuit then between PGE and Bechtel over who was going to pay for the shutdown. And the two parties, as the case approached trial, went to the federal judge and said, what we've learned about how this plant was built should never see the light of day. And we can settle this case, but only if Your Honor signs a gag order saying that anybody that has anything to do with this case or ever learns anything about the case, any of the facts that came out in discovery in this case, if they ever tell anybody what they know, they'll go to jail for it. And that order was signed by the judge. In fact, a succession of judges signed very similar orders. So the entire file, if you go to look up PGE versus Bechtel at the federal courthouse, you'll see a file that's got about two pieces of paper in it saying none of your business. But the heart of the secret file was ultimately, some 5 years later, leaked to Lloyd Morbet. And it showed that that PGE's engineers, a firm called Preece Gowdy out of San Francisco, a world-class firm, looked at Trojan and said that basically if you sneezed, it would fall over.
Okay, one last question. What's the weirdest, wackiest fact or the most ironic thing about Trojan, its history, blowing it up, the fact that it's so central to The Simpsons, any of that? What's your favorite wacky Trojan fact?
When Bechtel was building Trojan, they had a great team of nuclear engineers, but they ran out of them because they were building nuclear plants all over the country. So by the time they got to Trojan, with this little backwater utility, you know, PGE, they didn't have any nuclear engineers to design and build the plant. So they turned to what in the secret testimony was called the engineering equivalent of Kelly girls. And that's who built Trojan. The first guy who was assigned the job was named Muhammad Ali. And he, you know, got them up to the point where they're about ready to start pouring concrete. And somebody said, by the way, can we see your earthquake calculations showing that this thing will stand up? And he said, earthquake calculations? He hadn't done any. And so he was fired, and they brought in a guy named James Edmonds, another guy from, you know, the engineering equivalent of Kelly girls. And Edmonds designed the plant. And the when he was later questioned during the PGE Bechtel litigation, that you know, where they kept that file secret for years and years and years until it was leaked, his testimony was a great eye opener. He was asked by one of the lawyers for PGE, Mr. Edmonds, prior to designing the Trojan nuclear power plant, had you ever before designed a nuclear plant? And he said, well, no. I said, well, had you ever designed an entire structure for earthquake resistance? He said, no, I don't believe I have. Well, prior to designing the Trojan nuclear power plant, had you ever before designed an entire structure? He says, no, not an entire structure. He said, well, had you ever designed a composite wall for earthquake resistance? He said, no. He said, well, prior to designing the Trojan nuclear power plant, sir, had you ever before designed a wall? And James Edmonds said, no.
That was Portland attorney Greg Cufori speaking to KBOO's Lisa Loving. Tune in all this week for ongoing Trojan implosion coverage. And don't miss the KBOO Evening News next Monday night, May 22nd, for exclusive coverage of the implosion and its after effects. And we promise we'll be much better than the local TV stations.
The Supreme Court is taking a pass on a Washington State case about the rights of a gay parent. The High Court has refused to stop a lesbian from seeking parental rights to a child she helped raise with her partner. Justices might have used the case to clarify child custody disputes in non-traditional families, but they declined without comment. The Washington State Supreme Court said Sue Ellen Carvin is a, quote, de facto parent and could pursue parental rights with a girl who is now 11 years old. The girl's biological mother, Paige Britton, said that that could pave the way for children to have an unlimited and ever-changing number of parents. Carvin and Britton lived together for 12 years. Britton was artificially inseminated and gave birth in 1995. They raised the daughter together for 6 years. Carvin stayed home, and the girl called her Mama. The girl called Britton Mommy. Britton and Carvin split. Britton married the sperm donor and barred Carvin from seeing the girl.
Carvin sued in November 2002 in King County Superior Court in Seattle.
Lawyers are arguing pretrial motions in the Fort Lewis case of a decorated soldier accused of killing his wife. The court martial of Brandon Bear started this afternoon at Fort Lewis. Bear, of Wilkesboro, North Carolina, is charged with premeditated murder in the death of 18-year-old Nabila Bear last July in the couple's kitchen. She'd been stabbed at least 70 times with knives and a meat cleaver. The 20-year-old Brandon Bear was home after being wounded in Iraq in a grenade attack on his Stryker Brigade unit in Mosul. He was awarded a Purple Heart for his combat injuries. If convicted, he faces a maximum of life in prison. Two other Fort Lewis soldiers have been convicted of murdering their wives in the past 7 years.
The U.S. House of Representatives this evening passed legislation honoring the men and women who make the ultimate sacrifice while serving our nation in the armed forces. The legislation, as well as similar legislation pending in California's State Assembly, targets a right-wing Christian group that pickets military funerals around the nation under the rubric, quote, God hates fags. The group, which is a church congregation based in Topeka, Kansas, believes the U.S. military is being defeated in Iraq in part because of the U.S. acceptance of homosexuality. The group is led by Pastor Fred Phelps. The Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act, H.R. 5037, co-sponsored by Congressman Greg Walden, an Oregon Republican, would prohibit demonstrations from taking place at a ceremony during a funeral or memorial service for military personnel. The bill passed by a vote of 408-3 and now heads to the Senate for their consideration.
President George W. Bush's political advisor Karl Rove said today he worries about the Iraq war contributing to a sour public mood, but Republicans would be just fine in November's congressional elections. Rove, who is under investigation in the leak of a CIA covert operative's name, defended Bush's handling of the economy and shrugged off polls showing growing public concern over America's future and disapproval of Bush's leadership. But Rove dismissed predictions that Bush's falling public approval rating, down to as low as 29% in one poll, was a sign of looming Republican disaster when voters decide the balance of power in Congress in November. Rove added Bush had helped revive a foundering economy with his tax cuts and trade policies. But while consumer confidence is high, he said, the effect of the war had taken its toll on the public's long-range confidence about the future. The speech was Rove's first major public appearance since losing his policy advisor portfolio in a recent White House staff shakeup. Rove, the architect of Bush's 2000 and 2004 presidential wins, now concentrates on politics.
U.S. Air Force General Michael Hayden's chances of winning Senate confirmation to head the CIA may depend on how he explains his involvement in eavesdropping and data collection programs, two key senators said yesterday. Senator Chuck Hagel, a Nebraska Republican, said that there's no question that his confirmation is going to depend upon the answers he gives regarding activities of the NSA. Hagel, who has expressed support for the nomination, said Hayden's involvement in the NSA's eavesdropping and telephone records collection programs was still unclear. The NSA, which Hayden headed from 1999 to 2005, began intercepting telephone calls and emails without warrants between people in the United States and other countries after the September 11th attacks. It also inadvertently intercepted some domestic traffic, the New York Times reported last year. Appearing on the same program, Senator Joe Biden, a Delaware Democrat, said while he was inclined to support the nomination, Hayden must give a full accounting of his involvement in setting up domestic spying programs. Hayden, whose nomination is already under heavy scrutiny because of concerns about an active-duty military officer heading the civilian spy agency, expects tough questioning this week.
The Senate has resumed debate on new compromise legislation, which is cause for concern on both sides of the immigration debate. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The president will focus on border security in his address to the nation. He's expected to outline a plan to temporarily deploy thousands of National Guard troops to the southern border. Republican Senator Mal Martinez from Florida supports the idea.
What we need is for the president to lay out an agenda and a plan that will give people the comfort that they need to understand that we're serious about border security and that this administration is going to implement actions that will secure the border.
Republicans like Martinez say the president erred on not coming out on border security first before pushing the guest worker program. This could be seen as the president's attempt to secure conservative support. But Angela Kelly with the National Immigration Forum said the military isn't the way to control the border.
I think there's big worries about, you know, the culture, the goal, the objective, the accountability with military forces that, you know, is just, it's different, quite frankly, than when, you know, you think about the Border Patrol and what its job is.
Mexico's President Vicente Fox called the president Sunday to express concern for the proposal, highlighting that the U.S. and Mexico are friends. President Bush assured him the troops would be there temporarily. Meanwhile, down the street at the U.S. Capitol, the Senate began the second round of debate on the immigration bill. The base legislation, known as Hagel-Martinez, would create a guest worker program that allows 325,000 low-wage workers in the U.S. each year. Furthermore, the bill would increase the number of employment-based visas to 450,000 per year for 10 years. Both groups would be able to bring their children and spouse. As for extended family members of the worker, it would increase the number of those to 480,000 each year. But some conservatives say this bill is allowing an obscene number of immigrants into the U.S., and they say it would have an adverse impact on the economy and government spending. The Conservative Heritage Foundation and Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama conducted similar studies that said the Hagel-Martinez legislation would allow 200 million lawful immigrants in 20 years. Robert Rector is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
What we must understand is that among illegal immigrants currently in the United States, about half of them are high school dropouts. They also have defined two factors that would measure predicted future receipt of welfare. Those are the two factors that you would choose.
Senator Sessions hopes to offer an amendment that would greatly reduce the number of proposed visa allotments. The Hagel-Martinez legislation is a three-tiered system that determines immigrant status based on how long they have resided in the U.S. Those in the middle tier, who have lived in the U.S. for 2 to 5 years, will have to return to their country of origin to register with the U.S. government. Those in this category, also known as the guest worker, must renew the program after 3 years. But they are allowed to petition the government to get permanent legal status. But immigrant rights advocates also have deep concerns with the legislation.
There was a compromise reached just before the spring break that the Congress took, and this compromise has in it some landmines for these people in the 2 to 5 year range.
Angela Kelly is with the Immigration Forum. She says immigrants who provide wrong information once they register with the government are deemed ineligible to apply. Furthermore, the immigrant gives up their right to an appeal and judicial review of their immigration status.
There is a strong likelihood that people will be afraid to come forward to apply, that attorneys and service providers will advise people, you've got a lot at risk here. You'd have your family, your job, your life here.
A coalition of immigrant rights groups will have a series of mobilizations planned this week and through the November elections. They will include a march and rally in D.C. this Wednesday, the registration of 1 million new voters by October, the naturalization of eligible immigrants who haven't yet done so, and a massive march in September. The Senate will debate and amend the immigration legislation all week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
New York City is suing 15 gun shops after a stint... New York City is suing 15 gun shops after a sting operation that stretched to 5 states. The city says the shops supply a lot of the guns flowing into New York, including some that wound up in the hands of criminals. The city says it hired private investigators who tried to make, quote, straw purchases from dealers in Ohio, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Virginia. While hidden cameras rolled, an investigator filled out paperwork for a purchase. Then, when the background check was passed, the gun buyer pretended to hand the weapon to someone who wasn't cleared for gun ownership. In addition to damages and compensation, the lawsuit asks the federal court to order supervision and extra training for the dealers.
Boeing Corporation has reached a tentative settlement with the government that calls for it to pay $615 million to end a three-year Justice Department investigation into reported defense contracting scandals. While agreeing to the largest financial penalty ever imposed on a military contractor, Boeing will not face criminal charges or have to admit wrongdoing, officials said, on condition of anonymity. A settlement could go a long way toward helping the company, the second largest U.S. defense contractor behind Lockheed Martin, in its effort to distance itself from recent procurement controversies that tainted its reputation. The federal official told the Associated Press that the company pressed to complete negotiations before its annual investor conference Wednesday in St. Louis. Boeing executives are scheduled to discuss the corporation's performance and outlook during that meeting.
Authorities say the dynamite that towing company workers found inside a pickup truck in Moreno Valley, California, appears to match sticks that were stolen earlier this month from a Big Bear City gold mine. Sunday's discovery would be the third batch of dynamite that has been recovered since the May 3rd theft from the California Gold Mining Company. Employees reported 686 sticks of explosives and a bag of chemicals were taken from a storage bunker. Riverside County Sheriff's Deputy Craig Roberts says the towing company workers found the dynamite in a backpack while searching the pickup, which had been reported stolen. The towers were called when a Moreno Valley police officer who found it was unable to contact the owner.
Teen smoking and drinking continue to drop, but teenage abuse of prescription drugs has become an entrenched behavior that many parents fail to recognize, a survey released last week showed. For a third straight year, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America study showed that about one in five teens have tried prescription drug painkillers, such as Vicodin or Oxycontin, to get high, about 4.5 million teens. It's also indicated that many teens feel experimenting with prescription drugs is safer than illegal highs. 40% said prescription medicines were much safer than illegal drugs, while 31% said there was nothing wrong with using prescription drugs once in a while. The study further found that 29% of teens believe prescription pain relievers are non-addictive. Although this was the group's 18th annual survey, it marked only the third year of compiling figures on the abuse of legal drugs. In 2003, the study found 20% of teens had tried the prescription drugs Vicodin, Oxycontin, and Tylox. Over the next 2 years, the numbers remained fairly consistent.
About 200 small school districts will have to shut down before June 15th after the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday rejected a final appeal without comment. Former Nebraska Attorney General Don Stenberg had argued that the law requiring the elementary-only school districts to merge with larger K-12 districts was unconstitutional. Small school backers argue the districts should determine their own future and not be forced by the state to merge with larger schools. Merger proponents say that having K-12 districts statewide will save money and provide a more equitable education to all students. The law requiring the small school districts to close was passed last year over Governor Dave Heineman's veto. Opponents circulated a petition seeking a vote to repeal the measure. Enough signatures were gathered to put the question on the November ballot, where it lost. The schools won a restraining order from a Lancaster County judge putting the law on hold until the election, but when the state appealed, the law was allowed to proceed. The U.S. Supreme Court last month rejected Stenberg's request for an injunction to block the law.
Bausch & Lomb has permanently withdrawn a new formula contact lens cleaner viewed as the potential root cause of a far-flung outbreak of fungal eye infections known to cause blindness. In a related story, Bausch & Lomb's stock, hit hard over the last month, rose nearly 12% on the announcement. The company suspended U.S. sales of MoistureLock on April 13th after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it was investigating a spike in infections in Americans using the product. The outbreak first surfaced in the Far East, leading to a halt in sales in Singapore, Hong Kong, and Malaysia on February 18th.
This spring, sea lions have been demonized and even physically threatened for daring to eat salmon along Oregon and Washington rivers. In California, the pinnipeds have started trashing property. Authorities hope spraying sea lions with water will chase them off boats docked in Newport Beach and back into the bay.
The sea lions have returned to the marina after wreaking havoc last summer by trashing boat cabins and decks and barking all night. A marina worker says they've ransacked one craft so far this spring and nearly scuttled a 20-foot sailboat. He says the sailboat was submerged to the rooftop before shipyard workers intervened. Harbor officials are testing a high-tech device to stave off a repeat of last year's mayhem. It's a motion-activated sprinkler they hope will shoo the animals away from boat decks. Why would it work? Well, sea lions sunbathe to raise their body temperature and don't like being squirted with cool water.
And the current time is 5:34. And now, time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The grannies have been freed. If you ever doubted that personal activism can be effective, inspirational, and fun, check out the recent success in New York City of the Granny Peace Brigade. Last fall, these 18 ladies, ranging from 62 to 91 years old, descended on an Army recruiting station in Manhattan. They wanted to enlist and be sent to Iraq in the place of young people who otherwise would have to go. Kill us, not them, was their plea, a grandmotherly gesture to focus public attention on the deadly price of Bush's war of lies. When told to go away, they simply sat down, for which they were arrested, handcuffed, jailed, and charged with disorderly conduct. The prosecutor offered to dismiss the charges if the grannies agreed not to cause any trouble for 6 months. No deal, shouted the 18, instead demanding their day in court. As one put it, we are at a very important point in the history of our country. It is our responsibility as patriots not to be silent. In their 6-day trial, prosecutors claimed the women had blocked access to the recruiters. But Judy Lear responded that if someone had approached, she would have moved over. I'm a very polite person, she noted. Well, sniffed prosecutors, you people weren't really prepared to go to war. To which Diana Dreyfus retorted, I was totally prepared. I'd just recently gotten divorced. I was ready. When the judge finally dismissed all charges, the grannies happily gathered with their lawyer, who told them, the decision today says the First Amendment protects you to protest peacefully. So, go do it. The grannies cheered. This is Jim Hightower saying, an old cliche declares that if you're not a liberal at 20, you have no heart. But if you're not a conservative at 40, you have no brain. Maybe so, but if you're not a radical by 60, you're really not living at all. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. hear Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. In the weather, summer's off to a warm and cloudy start in the Willamette Valley. Today's high hit a whopping 96 degrees. Closer to 80 and 85 for the rest of the week. In the Columbia Gorge, cooler and cloudier, 94 today, then dropping to the 80s and down to 71 by Friday. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
As Canada continues to harmonize its security policies with the United States, fighting the so-called war on terror, many tactics created in the U.S. are being exported north of the border. A new prison, which some call Guantanamo North, has opened recently and has drawn harsh criticism across the country. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
Stephen Harper, shut down Guantanamo North, they chanted over the weekend, as over 100 people gathered in the pouring rain in Montreal to demonstrate against a new prison which opened up recently near Kingston, Ontario. The Millhaven Penitentiary, Canada's newest detention facility, is unlike any other in the country. The prison contains only 6 cells, but was built specifically to lock up detainees under security certificates, a measure used against non-Canadian citizens who are considered a threat to national security. The Millhaven Penitentiary has been dubbed Guantanamo North by many because of its striking resemblance to the Guantanamo Bay Military Detention Camp in Cuba, a place where prisoners are held indefinitely without charges, no access to a fair trial, and under secret evidence. Amir Kadir is a politician and activist with Quebec Solidaire.
Guantanamo isn't just a prison on a Caribbean island. It's also a system built to repress, a system built to frighten, violate rights, and to prevent resistance from developing. The erosion of our liberties begins with people who are the most vulnerable.
Saturday's demonstration in Montreal was part of a cross-Canada series of actions to pressure the federal government to close down the new prison. Similar demonstrations have taken place over the last weeks in Toronto, Vancouver, Kingston, Quebec City, Halifax, and Ottawa. Salam El-Manyawi is the president of the Muslim Council of Montreal.
These people are not accused of any crime. This is totally unacceptable, and we will reject this kind of presence, whether it is for few or it is for total group of people.
Mohamed Majoub, Hassan Omre, Mohamed Harkat, and Mahmoud Jabala were recently transferred to Millhaven. The four inmates were transferred to Millhaven on April 24th, just one day after the People's Commission on Immigration Security Measures was held in Montreal. The People's Commission brought hundreds of people from different communities together to draft a report on racial profiling and the effects of the war on terrorism in Canada. Critics of Guantanamo North see Canada's security policies taking an intensified turn to the right, especially after electing Prime Minister Stephen Harper in January. Latifa Sherkawi, the Moroccan-born mother of Adil Sherkawi, a man detained in Montreal on a security certificate for 2 years, explains.
This is why we chose this land, to lead a better life. But unfortunately, we have found that since September 11, Canada has really changed. It is following the Americans in fighting terrorism. But in my opinion, given that I am a Canadian, I do not think that Canada should follow the Americans.
From June 13th to 15th, the Supreme Court in Ottawa will determine the constitutionality of Canada's controversial security certificates. Despite this, Harper has decided to go ahead and open the Millhaven Penitentiary. And in early June, a freedom caravan will travel from Toronto to Ottawa to stage a multi-day rally in front of the Supreme Court. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal, Quebec.
KBOO brings you breaking news at this hour.
The court split 6 judges to 5 with Israel's...
In breaking news, President Bush said tonight he will send as many as 6,000 National Guard troops to the U.S. border with Mexico to help stop the flood of illegal immigrants, part of an administration drive to win conservative support in Congress for an election year overhaul of the nation's tattered immigration laws. In a primetime address from the Oval Office, the president said, quote, "We do not yet have full control of the border, and I am determined to change that," end quote. Bush gave strong support to a plan that would give many of the 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States an eventual chance of citizenship, a move derided by some conservatives as amnesty. The president rejected that term. The Guard troops would mostly serve 2-week stints before rotating out of the assignment. So keeping the force level at 6,000 over the course of a year could require up to 156,000 troops. Still, Bush insisted, quote, "The United States is not going to militarize the southern border," end quote. The president timed his speech hours after the Senate began intense debate on an election year immigration bill. The rare, televised, primetime Oval Office address signified the high stakes for Bush, who has been asking for an immigration overhaul since his 2000 campaign.
The human rights group Amnesty International has described Israel's decision to uphold a law preventing West Bank Palestinians from moving to Israel to live with their families as discriminatory. The Israeli Supreme Court has rejected appeals to change the law, which was passed in 2002. The law is believed to have prevented thousands of Palestinians joining their spouses who live in Israel. The Israeli government says the law was based on security concerns and that the recent election victory of the militant group Hamas strengthened its case.
Europe will help Iran to develop a, quote, proliferation-proof nuclear power program in exchange for the regime agreeing to halt uranium enrichment on its own soil.
The offer is one of a series of incentives unveiled in Brussels today, which are designed to succeed in reining in the Islamic Republic, where the faltering threat of sanctions has failed. In advance of a general meeting of EU foreign ministers this afternoon, Javier Solana, the EU's foreign policy chief, told reporters that the package would also include financial aid and possibly defense assistance. Reuters obtained a draft statement due to be read at the meeting, which it quoted as saying that the EU could help Tehran to develop a, quote, safe, sustainable, and proliferation-proof civilian nuclear program. The EU's package is, however, likely to be rejected. Iran's president gave warning yesterday that he would under no circumstances accept any offer backed by a demand that Iran stopped what he described as its peaceful nuclear activities. Rejection of such a broad offer would add to the pressure on China, and in particular Russia, to agree to demands from the United States and Europe to impose a resolution against the regime, including possible sanctions, through the UN Security Council.
Two Ugandans working as security contractors in Iraq slipped into a coma after being assaulted and sodomized on the grounds of a U.S. airbase. This according to Uganda's Monitor newspaper, which reported the abuse came after 600 Ugandans working as guards at the U.S. base protested over poor wages and working conditions. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Tlaib have more.
The 600 Ugandans who guard the U.S. airbase Camp Gettysburg west of Baghdad are among the 25,000 soldiers in Iraq who aren't members of any army. They're mercenaries. The Brookings Institute's P.W. Singer notes more and more mercenaries are flooding into Iraq as the occupation becomes unpopular in the U.S. and around the world.
You use contractors as a mechanism to get around some of the political costs of the war. If you didn't have that 25,000 contractors there, you'd either have to send in more U.S. troops, you'd either have to call in more National Guard reservists. Neither one of those would be too popular, either here or in Iraq, or you'd have to convince more allies to send their troops. And to be frank, that's not really working right now. So they're using private contractors as a stopgap.
Some mercenaries make top dollar, especially retired American and British soldiers. But the Ugandans working at Camp Gettysburg make less than $1,000 a month, making them cheaper than American soldiers. According to the country's Monitor newspaper, the Ugandan guards also felt they had been tricked into taking the dangerous job of guarding a base in the Sunni Triangle. They said they had signed with one contractor based in Dubai, who then sold them to a Nevada-based security company called SOC-SMG. Again, P.W. Singer of the Brookings Institute.
This industry is like every other industry out there, and it's globalizing. And yet, even though they're global and often multinational, there are different, we do see patterns in terms of who are the investors, who are the executives, white-collar command positions versus blue-collar field positions. It's just because it's military doesn't mean that many of the things that are going on in global business don't happen in the private military business as well.
What's different in the military business is the violent nature of occupied Iraq. When the workers complained, the Monitor newspaper reports they were beaten and two were sodomized until they fell into a coma. Both the security contractor, SOC, and the U.S. military spokesperson in Baghdad were not available to comment by deadline for this story. Salam Anami worked as a translator for the U.S. military in Mosul for 3 years before quitting earlier this month. He says Asian contractors who work the night shift were regularly treated as prostitutes by U.S. troops.
We had chow, we had food 4 times a day, but the last time was at midnight. At midnight, many few people came and eat something. The cooks, most of them were girls, so they came around. Most of them came for the last food. You know, one American told me, "Hey Sam," they told me, "Sam, hey, if you want a girl, I can hook you up." All these girls are hookers, you know what I mean? They're whores.
Anami says rules against fornication on base were barely enforced. He describes when one of his friends, a U.S. soldier, disappeared for 4 days.
One day one soldier came. He was my friend. He came to my room many times. And like for 3-4 days, I didn't see him. I feel that something wrong with him. So I asked about him and he didn't show up yet, and I asked about his roommate. He told me, "I don't know, I have no clue where he is." So one day he just show up, you know. I told him, hey, speak of the devil. Where have you been, man? Where have you been keeping yourself? Then he told me that I was sleeping with, you know, inside the base, we have Asians, women, or Turkish, you know, Turkish people. They cook, you know, they are cooking. I mean, so he was sleeping with an Asian girl for 3-4 days, you know.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
The United States is imposing a ban on arms sales to Venezuela because of what it sees as a lack of support by President Hugo Chavez's government for counterterrorism efforts, the State Department said today. For nearly a year, there has been a total lack of cooperation with anti-terrorism, Darla Jordan, a State Department spokeswoman, said. As a result, U.S. sales and licensing for the export of defense articles and services to Venezuela, including the transfer of defense items, will not be permitted, she said. Venezuela is a major supplier of oil to the United States, but relations between Chavez and the Bush administration have sharply deteriorated. Chavez has called Bush a terrorist and denounced the U.S.-led war in Iraq. The United States also has been tracking with concern what Department spokesman Tom Casey called Venezuela's multi-billion-dollar arms acquisition program. Meanwhile, Chavez has earned popularity points.
Two rebel groups in Sudan's Darfur region say they will ignore an African Union deadline to sign a peace deal aimed at ending 3 years of war in the region. FSRN's Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The Sudanese government and one rebel group have already signed the peace agreement in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. The African Union intends to start implementing the agreement on Wednesday, and it has given Monday as the deadline for the two rebel groups to sign it. The rebel leaders say they will not sign the deal because it does not favor them. The rebel group's refusal to sign the peace deal has sparked fears that peace may not return to the Darfur region. The African Union has warned that the rebel groups could face international sanctions if they do anything to undermine the peace process. In the meantime, many people in the Darfur region have been killed in recent days during violent protests against the peace deal. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
At least 52 people have been killed in Brazil's commercial capital, Sao Paulo, after a series of organized attacks against the police and security forces. Authorities say the unrest, which started on Friday and continued until Sunday, was being directed by a jailed criminal gang known as the First Command of the capital. The unrest began after 700 of its gang members were sent to maximum security prisons. Revolts also broke out in dozens of prisons, and 200 people were taken hostage.
The Spanish government says it will step up action to tackle illegal immigration in the Canary Islands after nearly 1,000 people arrived in boats from Africa over the weekend. At least 5,000 immigrants are believed to have made the journey this year. Hundreds of people die every year attempting the treacherous crossing to the islands.
An entirely different kind of April shower hit Astoria High School during a track meet last month. The home team may not have been as surprised as the visitors when fish began falling from the sky. Rick Klumpf, acting Northwest Regional Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, told the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission Friday at its monthly meeting in Burns that the meet's javelin competition was briefly interrupted by 7 to 8 inch coho salmon smolts falling onto the field. The high school is on the Young's Bay shoreline, where several hundred thousand hatchery coho had just been planted in the bay. They'll be next year's returning salmon for Buoy 10 Sport and Young's Bay commercial fishing. A combination that day of the large size of the smolts, harassment of the terns by larger gulls, and the terns' practice of handing catches off to their mates caused the hapless baby salmon to drop onto the track below. Klumpf said the tern colony has been successfully relocated to another area of the Lower Columbia where they don't take as many salmon smolts.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 15th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Lisa Loving and Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Our engineer is Brian Averill. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Their guest is Josh McPhee, printmaker and stencil designer of political street art. At 9 on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach interviews Sarah Waters, author of The Night Watch, a suspense novel set in World War II London. At 9:30, Rabia Yemin interviews Liz Pearl, longtime editor and publisher, about her book Money, a Memoir, Women, Emotions, and Cash. At 10, environmental journalist Elizabeth Grossman talks about high-tech trash. Her new book examining the dark side of where computers and other electronic equipment comes from and where they go when you're done with them. At 10:30, on a special edition of Stage and Studio, host Dime Roberts looks at the experiences and contributions of Southeast Asian refugees who came to Portland after the U.S. withdrawal from the Vietnam War in 1975. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all coming up on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 15th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The chair of the Canadian House of Commons Aboriginal Affairs Committee has been forced to step down. As Craig McCulloch reports, comments the Conservative politician made to a reporter is what spurred the decision.
The Conservative member of Parliament was forced to resign as the chair of the Aboriginal Affairs Committee after saying Canada's chief judge presumed godlike powers on the bench. Maurice Vellacott made the comments a few days before his resignation in a television interview. The comments spurred the Supreme Court itself to issue a rare statement refuting the Conservative politician's assertion. If Vellacott, who is from the province of Saskatchewan, had not resigned, he most likely would have been removed by a vote of non-confidence. Opposition politicians serving on the committee were to have a vote of non-confidence the same day. Their combined votes would have removed him as chair. Vellacott had earlier defended the actions of two police officers who dumped an Aboriginal man outside of Saskatoon in the middle of winter. In resigning, he says that he is saddened, and he hoped that he could improve the living conditions for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. The new chair of the committee has also been criticized for earlier comments. Conservative MP Colin Hayes was recently forced to apologize for saying that journalists would be more accurate if they faced jail time for inaccurate reporting. For Independent Native News, I'm Craig McCulloch.
The primary radio station serving South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation is off the air. Keeley went down about 2 weeks ago after lightning struck its antenna. For more than 20 years, Keeley has played a vital role in connecting people on the reservation. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Julia Munzunski has the story.
Keeley radio director Tom Casey says for many years, the station has been the sole source of daily local news and information on Pine Ridge. Casey says now everywhere he goes, people stop him to ask when the station will be up and running again.
And my answer has to be, and it is, we will be back. We will definitely be back on the air, but I can't tell you when.
Casey says the station is applying for emergency funding from a federal telecommunications agency. Keeley's proposal is for $201,000 to replace the entire transmission package. The station itself must raise 25% of that money. Casey says it's difficult to be without Keeley right now.
So I ask people to take the bigger view, that we're down now, and on an immediate basis, it's a problem because it's silent and we don't have that daily connection to the people. But in the end, we will be back, and we'll be back in a better way.
If the grant comes through, Casey says, the radio station would be up to date and able to run for the next 25 years. For Independent Native News, I'm Julia Munzunski.
In northern Wisconsin and Minnesota, Anishinaabe netters and spearers are completing their spring fishing season. The tribal fishing, hunting, and gathering rights are based on treaties signed back in the 1800s. These rights were reaffirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999 in the case Mille Lacs versus Minnesota. But as Nick Vanderpai from the Superior Broadcast Network reports, one Anishinaabe netter says treaty rights are really inherent rights of tribes.
An elder from Lac des Flambeaux, Mike Chosa, has gathered here with his brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews to gillnet walleye.
Really not our treaty rights, but our inherent rights for subsistence. Great Spirit ordered us to take care of those rights when he first established Turtle Island. And he told the Indians, he says, I provide this for you here, for your well-being. I provided wild rice, birds, game, and fish. And so our people have been doing that for centuries and centuries and centuries, doing that.
It wasn't always this peaceful. During the 80s and early 90s, as a treaty rights case was making its way through federal courts, some Anishinaabe met with violent protests at the landings. Almost 20 years later, the Anishinaabe survive.
Pretty tough to know, to remember what our families had to go through to protect these rights.
On the Mille Lacs Reserve, I'm Nick Vanderpai.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.